Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, December 7th, 2023. The U.S. State Department said both Sudan's warring factions have committed war crimes.
Warring parties must comply with their obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and we call on them to protect civilians, hold accountable those responsible for atrocities and other abuses.
And a cholera outbreak is ripping through parts of Sudan.
The cholera outbreak started here in September in areas in the east, which are concentrations of internally displaced from the conflict that started here in April between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We begin here in the U.S., where the United States State Department said Wednesday that the Sudan Armed Forces and their Rapid Support Forces have committed war crimes in their ongoing conflict. It said members of the RSF and allied militias have committed crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing. Secretary of State Antony Blinken added that the SAF and the RSF must stop the conflict now and comply with their obligations under international humanitarian and human rights law. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller spoke to reporters in Washington yesterday.
The SAF and the RSF must end this brutal conflict. The warring parties must comply with their obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and we call on them to protect civilians, hold accountable those responsible for atrocities and other abuses, allow unhindered humanitarian access, and negotiate an end to this conflict. For too long, the belligerents have killed, raped, and attacked civilians with impunity in Sudan. The international community must work towards meaningful justice for victims and the affected communities and bring an end to this era of impunity.
Miller said the U.S. will continue to push for peace and democracy in Sudan.
The United States stands with the Sudanese people, who did not ask for this war, in support of their rightful demands for a transition to democracy and freedom, peace, and justice. We will use all the tools at our disposal to support these aims.
Earlier in the week, the U.S. imposed its latest wave of sanctions on three individuals who serve in the ousted Omar al-Bashir administration for their role in destabilizing Sudan and undermining peace. Miller said the U.S. is prepared to impose more sanctions on individuals and entities perpetrating the violence in Sudan.
We have imposed sanctions in the past, and just because we are not announcing sanctions today does not mean we will not impose additional measures in the future. I will also say I think it's important that the United States speak with moral clarity about what we see happening and what we can document, and that's what we've done here. We think there's real value in that, and we'll continue to do it.
The latest round of U.S.-Saudi mediated talks between Sudan's warring parties in the Saudi city of Jeddah hit another dead end earlier this week. Miller said the U.S. will not give up on Sudan and will continue to engage with regional actors to bring an end to the nearly eight-month-long conflict.
The talks in Jeddah broke down because both parties, the SAF and RSF, repeatedly refused to adhere to the commitments that they made at those talks. So what we will do is continue to work with our partners in the region to make clear that there can be no military solution to this conflict, to make clear that civilians continue to suffer multiple atrocities, and to try to continue to work with our partners in the region to bring an end to the conflict. But ultimately, that takes the two parties coming to the table, and not just coming to the table, but adhering to the commitments that they make, and so far that they have been simply unwilling to do that.
The Rapid Support Forces face allegations of orchestrating an ethnic massacre in West Darfur, 2 decades after the region experienced what the U.S. calls a genocidal campaign. In Khartoum, the capital, residents accused the paramilitary group of engaging in acts such as rape, looting, and the unlawful imprisonment of civilians. Additionally, experts suggest that the army's air and artillery assaults on residential neighborhoods where the RSF holds influence may constitute violations of international law. VOA contacted Sudan's ambassador to the U.S., Mohammed Idris, for comment on this report, but received no response. Additionally, we made calls to Sudan Armed Forces spokesperson, Brigadier General Nabil Abdullah, but he did not answer his phone. RSF advisor Yusuf Izzat also was unavailable for comment. However, he told VOA last week that the allegations of ethnic cleansing by the RSF in Darfur are false and mere media campaign against the RSF. He said all areas in West Darfur are safe and civilians are protected. Justin Brady, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Sudan, says at least 161 people have died from cholera in Sudan since September, with another 5,178 suspected cases. In talking with VOA's Yahya Suhib from OCHA's head office in Port Sudan, Brady starts out by describing where and when the outbreak started.
The cholera outbreak started here in September in areas in the east, which are concentrations of internally displaced from the conflict that started here in April between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. Those areas also host a large number of refugees from neighboring conflicts, as well as the host communities there. It has now spread to 9 states overall. And those include Khartoum and South Kordofan states, which are heavily impacted. Okay.
So, Justin, what is the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs? What is it doing about the situation?
Yeah, working with our health and water sanitation and hygiene partners to mount a response. That has been inhibited by access challenges, as I mentioned, in Khartoum and South Kordofan that have been affected by conflict, but also by bureaucratic impediments imposed by some state authorities.
So at least 161 people have died from cholera in Sudan and almost 5,178 suspected cholera cases. So how is that going to be handled?
Yeah, we're trying to respond to this, but cholera is something that once it's out of the bottle is very hard to get back in. That's why it's been very frustrating to be facing the challenges we have as far as access, and some of them imposed by the authorities themselves. The overall situation in the country is very, very difficult since the war began and has intensified in recent months and in the west of the country. And right now we are less than 40% funded, and water, sanitation, hygiene, and health, while some of the better funded areas of work are still well underfunded what they need. So in some ways we're responding with one arm tied behind our backs. Yeah, surely. Here in Port Sudan, what was a very small port city is now overwhelmed by the number of internally displaced who are here, as well as the UN and NGOs who have concentrated here. The infrastructure, like many of the cities where IDPs have gone to, is really by the authorities themselves. You know, the overall situation in the country is very, very difficult since the war began and has intensified in recent months.
So, Justin, who is in control where you are? And are you worried for your security?
The government, the Sudanese armed forces are in control of Northern State and Port Sudan where we are. We do have staff in other areas of the country, obviously. This conflict has moved in many different directions, so it isn't that I'm immediately worried about our here, but that could change, and we certainly have contingencies in place, as we must in these sort of situations. I spent 7 years in Somalia, so this is sort of rote, par for the course in these sort of environments where we're trying to respond to the people in need in the midst of conflict.
That's Justin Brady, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Sudan in Cambridge. Yahya Suhib. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLM-IO, is accusing the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in government, led by President Salva Kiir, of obstructing implementation of the 2018 peace deal. An SPLM-IG official disputes the claim, saying his party is committed to the peace process. Manyang David Maya reports for VOA from Juba.
Addressing reporters in Juba on Wednesday, Nathaniel Oyet, deputy chairperson of the SPLM-IO, accused the ruling SPLM-IG party of standing in the way of reforms stipulated in the peace agreement. Oyet says the SPLM-IG is obstructing efforts by lawmakers to amend two sections of the National Security Act, which give the National Security Service powers to arrest or detain suspects without a warrant.
The National Security Service Act 2014, Amendment Bill 2023, has stalled in the third reading stage due to insistence by the SPLM-IG to retain sections 54 and 55. The decision to renege on the resolution on sections 54 and 55 of the bill, therefore, not only tantamount to the violation of the agreement, but also undermines the security sector reforms towards democratic governance in the Republic of South Sudan.
President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar agreed to scrap the powers of the National Security Service to arrest suspects without a warrant for an arrest earlier this year. Later, an amended National Security Service bill was drafted and formally presented to the National Assembly to be passed into law. But Oyet says the SPLM-IG blocked progress on the bill.
It implies the SPLM-IG is determined to continue using the National Security Service as a coercive military force to restrict political space, civil liberty through intimidation, arrest, trial, and detention of citizens with impunity, contrary to the Constitution.
Oyet, who is also the Assembly's first deputy speaker, says the SPLM-IG constantly violates the peace deal and obstructs its implementation. He says the ruling party also denies funds for operating key institutions.
We continue to encounter mismanagement of public resources, lack of transparency in the production, sale, and management of oil revenues. There is no definite figures of the amount of crude oil produced per day, the revenue generated thereof, and how these revenues are appropriated to various spending agencies of government and services for the people.
Oyet also accuses the SPLM-IG of restricting his party from carrying out its activities across the country, and therefore says South Sudan is not ready for elections in December 2024. Kwal Atimbul, SPLM-IG Secretary for Parliamentary and Executive Caucuses, disputes Oyet's claims and strongly denies the ruling party is holding up work in parliament.
These are false accusations because those of IO, SPLM-IO, they want to review an order that was prepared when they were not there. Something is done when you were not there. How can you come and try to even adjust it? We are not refusing for the third reading. It is because the session was adjourned.
Atim also denies that the SPLM-IG is using public funds to conduct its campaigns.
This is a lie. There is no other party that is using the public resources. How can you use it? How can you use it? There are no papers that were prepared by SPLM to the Minister of Finance asking for the money. There is no other paper.
Atim accuses the SPLM-IO of looking for excuses to avoid elections in December 2024, saying the SPLM-IO, quote, wants to continue with the so-called peace agreement. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
You're You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at a call to end gender-based violence in South Sudan. Stay tuned.
People are marking the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Help us mark the work to end violence against women by sharing your thoughts on VOA's English to Africa radio programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076 before December 10th. Tell us what is being done in your community to fight gender-based violence and tell us why this issue is important to you. That number again is +1 202 258 3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A group of young activists is calling for an end to violence against women and girls in South Sudan. A nonprofit group, Action Girls Africa, says young women and girls should be engaged in the fight against gender-based violence and empowered to end barriers to gender equality in their communities. For VOA News, Charlton Doke reports from Juba.
Young women who gathered Thursday in Juba called for new efforts to engage women and girls in fighting gender-based violence in South Sudan. They made the call at a conference organized by Action Girls Africa, a non-profit advocacy group, to brainstorm on ways to end gender inequality in South Sudan. Moriba Margaret Stephen, a participant at the conference, says while gender-based violence against women and girls remains widespread in South Sudan, most rural women are unable to speak out about the abuses they face. She calls on all South Sudanese who have a platform to speak out against gender-based violence.
Violence against women and young girls is self-assisting in our country, so we cannot fold hands or keep quiet until we see that there is a change, until we see that there is end in gender-based violence in our country.
Aban Ayul works for the Corporate Business Cycle, a non-profit business organization in Juba. She says for South Sudanese society to change, the responsibility of advocating for an end to gender-based violence should not be left to non-profit organizations alone. She said cultural leaders, religious leaders, and the entertainment industry must all advocate for a South Sudan that is free of gender-based violence.
We have experienced a lot about forced marriage, that young girls are victims of now forced marriage, that it results to domestic violence, emotional violence, and physical violence, of which some of our societies are already avoiding the forced marriage and because they are being exposed now to education. But some of our cultures that are still allowing such things to happen, we are still advocating so hard to make sure the rate is zero.
Stephen appeals to women in political office and civil society groups to speak up on behalf of rural women who are either not aware of their rights or have no platform to speak for themselves.
We are the voices of those ones in the grassroots. We are the voices of those who did not get the chance to speak out. So we speak out on behalf of them because we believe we are our sister's keepers. And the solutions we come up with, we believe are the solutions that will help them wherever they are.
The young women say they think violence against women and girls will not end unless women get involved in advocating for their rights and fighting against abuse. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The United States Congress is urging a strong, coordinated U.S. response to tackle conflicts and instability in the Sahel, which it describes as dire as it examines its policy toward the region. VOA's Ignatius Anor reports from Capitol Hill.
Exacerbating conflict and instability in Sahelian nations like Sudan, Niger and Chad, and West Africa's Guinea, Mali and Burkina Faso prompted a congressional hearing by the U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee on Africa on December the 5th. The committee invited senior U.S. government officials to answer questions and provide a pathway to what it sees as a dire situation in the Sahel. John James, chair of the U.S. Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, questioned the U.S.'s commitment to bring in peace in Sudan, for example, citing funding to Ukraine to be more than 20 times the non-military assistance to Sudan.
Ukraine has a population of approximately 43.79 million people. Sudan has a population of approximately 45.66 million people. Yet the non-military assistance that has gone to Ukraine is $12.4 billion, and the humanitarian assistance to Sudan is $620 million. I've heard things like we need to do everything we possibly can. But what I see is you have almost identical population sizes, but 20 times the commitment financially to the people of Ukraine than the people in Sudan.
Molly Fee, Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of State Bureau of African Affairs, responded, saying the Sudanese people affirmed that the U.S. has been a true ally in trying to end the current turmoil.
My contacts with the Sudanese people tell me that they believe that we are the best friend to the nation. It is not Russia or China who showed up to try and help end this conflict. It was the United States. We are perceived to be disinterested and care about the civilians and care about the stability of the state. That is not the position of other partners in the international community. The strength we have is that they want to have a partnership with us and they want our help to resolve the conflict.
Celeste Walanda, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs at the U.S. Department of Defense, says extremist organizations are capitalizing on weak governments in the Sahel and are now approaching countries in the Gulf of Guinea.
In the short and medium term, we will support African-led counterterrorism operations to disrupt the most acute terrorist threats, with a particular emphasis on those targeting U.S. interests. In the long term, we will emphasize bilateral security assistance to African defense and security forces in order to build their own homegrown capacity to counter these threats without excessive external assistance.
Robert Jenkins is assistant to the administrator of the USAID's Bureau for Conflict Prevention and Stabilization. He says the donor agency is working to empower young people in the Sahel with the education and skills needed so they do not fall prey to extremist groups.
The U.S. has been the third largest contributor to the Global Partnership for Education, a multilateral organization providing education services in several countries across the Sahel. Peace and stability in the Sahel requires bringing peace and stability to Libya, which has served as a source of and destination for weapons and armed fighters.
The U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee on Africa says Russia is exploiting the instability within the Sahel via its paramilitary Wagner group to make profits and score geopolitical influence. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department is appealing to Congress to confirm much-needed ambassadors to the African Union, Nigeria, Niger, Somalia, Djibouti, and Gabon. Ignatius Anno, VOA News, Washington.
A surge of mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, in the Democratic Republic of Congo has scientists worried about a global outbreak, with at least 500 deaths linked to the virus this year. That's more than the number recorded last year when mpox was declared an international and U.S. health emergency. For the first time, scientists have identified sexual transmission of a version of mpox that is tied to more fatalities in a region where mpox is endemic and most often transmitted through contact with infected animals. Jason Kinderchuk, associate professor at the University of Manitoba's Max Reedy College of Medicine, Medical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that the threat of a global mpox outbreak never went away.
I think for us, you know, last year was a bit of a warning sign, right? So we saw the virus get outside of kind of the traditional borders where it's found, moved very rapidly to new geographic locations, we were able to suppress cases, but they're still ongoing in some areas. And then we kind of forgot about Mpox. I think from a public standpoint, this should serve as a bit of a reminder that, you know, that this disease has not disappeared. And certainly we don't understand everything about it. Last year, we had the benefit, I think, a little bit in the sense that we had a less severe form of monkeypox virus that moved globally. What we're seeing now in Democratic Republic of the Congo, more severe form. Now we're seeing a little bit of a difference in what we've traditionally thought about transmission and maybe some additional concerns in regards to new mechanisms or new modes. And now we need to understand what the impact is.
For the first time, scientists have identified sexual transmission of a version of this Mpox virus that's linked to more fatalities in a place where, you know, Mpox is endemic. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you know, last year was a bit of an alarm signal for us, right? We suddenly saw this surge in Mpox globally, you know, a little bit of a new flavor in terms of the type of monkeypox virus from what we had seen previously. But we had all these clusters of cases that were related back to sexual contact. Maybe transmission, we don't know for sure. A lot of data points to that, but definitely close sustained contact. And there was this overrepresentation within those that identify as gay, bisexual, or other men who have sex with men, which was different from what we had seen previously. Now we have this small cluster of cases in DRC, too small at this point to make a lot of assessments on whether or not the epidemiology follows with what we saw last year.
That's a little more scary, isn't it? Because we're not talking about infection from animals. We're talking about human-to-human infections.
Well, it is. And there's this piece of saying, okay, is this new or is it something that we had missed previously? And that is always kind of the piece that I think we try to contend with of, you know, has the virus changed or are we now seeing a bigger picture of what the virus can do because maybe we're looking or more attuned to a different type of presentation of this disease? Again, last year, presentation of Mpox, very different from what we had seen historically. Now we have to kind of look at this disease with a little bit of a new lens and say, okay, in endemic regions, what have we potentially missed? And what does that mean in regard to ongoing transmission and certainly risks for expansion of that virus?
Now, you've seen this in the DRC this year. Are you guys worried that it's going to pop up in other countries too in Africa?
Well, hey, certainly we're looking, right? I think for us, the biggest piece is if we look at regions that are adjacent to those endemic areas, do we see any inference that there has been kind of this cryptic transmission or transmission that's been going under the radar where people maybe have had symptoms that didn't look quite like Mpox and were largely self-resolving or because of stigma, they didn't move forward. What does that landscape look like? Also, from a global standpoint, now that, you know, we certainly have more resources in place to look for Mpox, I think a piece of this is now saying, okay, we can't just shut those down. We have to continue to be cognizant that the virus is still moving.
That's Jason Kinderchuk, Associate Professor at the University of Manitoba's Max Reedy College of Medicine, Medical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam from Manitoba, Canada. And that's all we have for you this Thursday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Awilo and the song Break Your Back. We've been listening to Awilo and the song Break Your Back. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.